This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up in our left-hand corner. On May 14, 2008, the senior statesman of Virginia hosted Senator Emmett Hanger, a Republican who was in his third term representing the Shenandoah Valley and a section of Albemarle County in the 24th Senatorial District. Hanger is introduced by Gene Davis.
I want to tell you all that we really welcome back our friend, Senator Emmett Hanger. He has been here before, and he's an excellent speaker, and he's an excellent friend and an excellent person. He's a member of the Shenandoah Valley Republicans, who are the bedrock of the Republican Party in Virginia. These people have been Republicans for decades, and they were led by former Governor Linwood Holton of Big Stone Gap, Virginia, and John Dalton of Radford, Virginia, and now they're led by Senator Emmett Hanger of Mount Solon and Delegate Steve Landis of Weir's Cave, and also Congressman Bob Goodlatte of the 6th Congressional District. Now, they also have a special connection, too, in their legislative aides, because Senator Hanger's legislative aide, Holly Herman, is the daughter of Delegate Landis' legislative aide and a cousin of Bob Goodlatte's legislative aide. So it's kind of in the family, too. I want to tell you special things about Senator Hanger. As you all know, he was a captain in the Army and commander of the Harrisonburg National Guard, so he has a military background. His wife is an educator. She's a teacher. And he is a member of the Board of Trustees of this new college that has just been created. And we look forward to hearing more about that in Southside Virginia. He also was with the Chesapeake Bay Commission. He chaired it. He's an environmentalist. But what I think is really, to me, the most important, he really is, I consider, the tax expert in Virginia. He co-chaired a study of Virginia taxes. I think it went for 3 years or more. And he went into deep research on that. It was a wonderful commission. They did a lot of good things, and they went back to the history of taxes in Virginia. And they went back to the laws that were affected or did affect the taxes in Virginia. He was a commissioner of revenue for Augusta County, and he has a Bachelor of Science in Accounting and Management and an MBA from James Madison. He's a businessman, and he knows the importance of finance, and he knows the intricacies and out part of finance. And that right now is exactly what we need in the General Assembly. I was in many hearings watching him and on the dais and listening to people, and he was always a gentleman, always what we Virginians are proud to call a gentleman. He was always nice to everybody who spoke, whether they spoke in opposition or for them. So I want you all to have the pleasure of hearing Senator Emmett Hanger.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. You know what? I was sitting back there just enjoying that. Sheen, thank you so much. You're very kind. And all of you are very kind. I've been before this group before. I know there are some new faces in the group, and it has been some time since I've been here. And I've been looking forward to having this opportunity. You always, with the schedule, we keep some time, you know, and you all do good pre-planning. I was asked whether this day was clear, May 14th, back probably last November. I'm not sure, but the but you never know, you know, in life what may come along, which will cause our paths to detour a little bit. But I certainly am pleased that it remained open and I'm able to be here. And indeed, I look forward to discussing some issues with you. And I can't recall, and I'm not sure what the format's going to be this afternoon, how long you want me to go. I'll try not to go too long. When I see y'all starting to nod off, I'll take that as a hint. But the hopefully, the few remarks that I make will engender some questions, and so we can have a little bit of a dialogue so I can speak more directly to what you're interested in rather than what it is that might be on the top of my head. In your proposed changes in bylaws, I certainly took note there. I guess once you pass that next month, then about half of y'all can admit that you're still 49. Is that the deal? Right. Exactly. We all, as we get into that 50 age group where I'm there now and have not only children but grandchildren, I still consider myself very young, but I'm getting there too, you know. That's where we are. So life moves on. Life is precious, and we certainly never ever should take any of the gifts that God grants us for granted. And I expect that y'all are well aware of that because you're involving yourself in something like this. If you were the type that were negative and just kept to yourself, you certainly wouldn't be here this evening expanding your mind and fellowshipping with friends of similar ideas. I've been asked to talk about the this past session of the General Assembly, and I'll do that with a bit of an outline I have here, touching on a few points and getting a little deeper into some areas than others. I spoke to a group of truckers last week who were very concerned on two fronts. One, they're kind of in a quandary. They want road improvements, and the other hand, you know, it's hard to make a living when you're paying $4 a gallon for diesel fuel. And so when I opened up with them, I shared this thought, and that is, what did the fish say when he ran into the concrete wall? He said, "Damn." And that's what some of these truckers perhaps were saying, and perhaps some of you all, hopefully you're not saying that when you wake up in the morning, but it's certainly very appropriate for a fish to say that, but not perhaps, but these truckers, when you wake up, like, how am I going to deal with all these issues? Now, the point is valid here, too, because I think we all, when we're confronted, bombarded, really, with the events of the day, not only the problems that we're confronted with in our household and with our neighbor, the people that are engaged in the media are kind enough to let us know everything that's wrong in the country, the world, the universe, on a constant basis, so we have to deal with all of that. Sometimes the old axiom, ignorance is bliss, is very appropriate, isn't it? If we didn't know about all these things, perhaps we wouldn't be as worried about them, and God would still take care of us, and everything would probably be okay. But that's not the case. We are aware of them, and many of us, once being aware of it, we feel a responsibility to be concerned about it, to worry about the people who were subjected to an earthquake yesterday in China, perhaps, or the people that had other troubles last week in the other countries, and or the people on the West Coast that are having difficulties, the people in other parts of Virginia, indeed, who've been subjected to the storms, the adverse weather conditions. So I was in Washington last Thursday and Friday. I'm still involved with the Chesapeake Bay Commission, and we had the a person fly in from New Orleans who was the scientist that did a lot of the work former Vice President Gore received his accolades for, as far as receiving the Nobel, and she shared in that, of course, from her work. But well, we were around the table joking about it, and you know, it was like, well, do you believe in global warming or not? You know, from a scientist's perspective, it's very real, and it's maybe not something that you choose to believe in or not. It's a reality in terms of those that are confronted with it and study it. But be what as it may, it's causing a lot of weird weather to happen. And I'm just thankful when we get just a normal spring day like we used to have, because it seems like they're very infrequent these days anymore. This past year in the budget that we dealt with, which was our primary work, we were dealing with a shortfall as we went in, which last year, as you received reports from the General Assembly, we were fortunate. We were still riding a fairly good economy in Virginia, and we still were running surpluses last spring. But this year was different. We had been confronted in closing out this fiscal year with a significant shortfall to the tune of roughly $700 million. And the governor had responsibility for closing part of that gap, and we did bridge that gap. In part, roughly half of that, we tightened our belt a bit. There were some layoffs around the state, some cutbacks in spending to the tune of roughly half of that $700 million figure. And the other portions of it we made up with various accounting maneuvers, pulling some money out of the rainy day fund. In total, we were closing out this fiscal year and then developing the budget for the next two fiscal years, we encountered a shortfall of roughly $2.1 billion. Of that, probably 70% of that was addressed through belt tightening, reducing the amounts that would have been projected to be spent in various areas, which in some cases, you know, in government accounting, it means reducing the amount of the projected increase as we plan for future expenditures. But be that what it may, we had to go through that exercise. We also took some money, roughly $360 million, from our rainy day fund, which has been pretty healthy the last few years. We've built that rainy day fund up to about $1.2 billion, and we now will be removing roughly $360 million from that to help in balancing the budget. That's what the money's there for, and I certainly supported that move. We also freed up some cash. Last year, in our capital budgeting process, where we would normally have a bond package to build state college and university buildings and other state buildings, things of that sort, last year we had cash available, so we were financing a lot of projects with cash that was available. We went back and converted some of those proposed cash expenditures to bond financing and freed up another roughly $400 million from that initiative, which allowed us then to balance out our books and have the cash to move forward. Quite a lot of initiatives contained within the budget, and I'd be pleased to address many of those or any of those that you specifically want to ask about when we get to the you know, questions and answers. Tax policy was mentioned. I have been involved in tax policy and tax reform for a number of years. Our most significant advance in tax reform was in 2004, where when Governor Warner was in, we did make some significant changes, and we've had a few changes since then. But that was the most significant time frame for changes that we had proposed. We need to continue working on them. I'm an advocate for basically taking the emphasis off of property taxes, which historically our local governments have been constrained by almost exclusively having to rely on property taxes, putting more emphasis on income tax and consumption taxes or sales taxes, which really are a better indicator of a person's ability to pay if we put the emphasis there. So I'd be pleased to speak to that a little more as we get to it. One area of tax policy that was proposed this year, which we did not pass, I actually supported the policy, but I did not support it this year, and that was a proposed constitutional amendment to allow a homestead exemption. That homestead exemption would allow, as it was proposed, would allow a local governing body to exempt up to 20% of the value of a person's residence, that was their primary residence, from the property tax at tax time. There were two problems that I had with it this year. One, the 20% constraint. I believe that if we're going to amend the Constitution, that we should just have a general provision which allows a homestead exemption with not being constrained by a certain percentage. The other issue, which was a very real issue in my mind, was that we had made no provision for the local governments to make up that money. We're giving them the ability in tight budget years to make up that money. If we gave them the ability, obviously you're going to expect that tax reduction. And we were not or had not proposed, come up with a way of for the local governments to replace those funds. Easy to say. Of course, they can just tighten their belt and reduce their spending, but that's obviously an easier concept in theory than in the reality, in particularly in times as we have now, where there are always additional demands for public safety, education, transportation, and what have you for those local dollars. We did accomplish this year some fairly significant mental health reform, and of course, some of that was reflected in the budgeting process itself. This is not really a new subject for us because we've been working on mental health reform or reforming our mental health delivery system for a number of years, as many of you are very much aware in the room, with the emphasis being on downsizing or right-sizing our institutions and putting more dollars and effort into community-based services. The impetus this year, of course, was the unfortunate tragedy at Virginia Tech, which is causing our mental health delivery system to be placed under a spotlight, if you will. So we addressed it, but it was nothing new in that we were already working on it, and this was just kind of a continuation of our efforts in mental health reform. We did put an additional $41 million into the effort as far as our mental health delivery system, and I think are more determined now to support our CSBs, our community-based services, in their delivery of services and right-sizing our mental health facilities. In our capital budget, which I'll mention just in passing, and I may come back to that, but just as it relates to mental health, one of the personal successes that I felt I had this past session with the cooperation of a lot of advocates was that we included money in our bond package to build a new psychiatric hospital in Stanton to replace the Western State facility there. So that was roughly $110 million in capital that we'll be spending there in the very near future to replace that hospital, which has a rich history, of course, in that region, this region, which it not only provides service to Western Virginia, but the service catchment area goes into Northern Virginia as well. That hospital has been there in Stanton, not that those buildings, but the old site was first put there in 1828. And the current facilities are more 1950s vintage. But decision has been made tentatively basically to raise all of that, to build a totally new hospital on the acreage there, to do some shuffling of land to build a totally new hospital. We also provided some funds in mental health in the area of our mental training centers, which specifically in Lynchburg, Central Virginia, and in the Southeast Training Center in Chesapeake, where we're going to, in Lynchburg, renovate significant renovation to facilities there. And in Chesapeake, the plan is to build a new facility there. So that was some progress, a commitment of resources to improve the delivery of those services. One of the areas that has been really troublesome that I've worked on quite a bit over the last couple of years is what's referred to as the Comprehensive Services Act. We have in Virginia a system set up, and it's kind of packaged all together, called the Comprehensive Services Act, where we provide services to at-risk, troubled youth, children essentially that have behavioral problems, that they may be foster children, that at-risk children that either through the courts or through various processes are in need of services, and the state and the local governments then have to provide those services. You know, as tight as the budget was this year, when we looked at, and once that child is there and they need those services, they fit into a certain category, it's kind of like of our Medicaid services or Medicare, where it's kind of an entitlement at that point. The state and the local government really don't have an option other than to come up with the money to provide that service. And this past year, between the closing out this year and the upcoming 2 years, we had to put in an additional $200 million, roughly $200 million, just to keep pace with demand for services under the Comprehensive Services Act. I've chaired a commission the last 2 years where we've begun to work on trying to come up with a system which is more cost efficient and also provides better services. And I've worked with a number of people in the administration, including the First Lady. Governor Kane's wife is in her profession, or at least in her profession before she became First Lady, and she's kind of taken a break from that. Was a juvenile domestic relations court judge and has been in close contact with some of these issues with these children, particularly foster care children. And so she had an interest in that, and I've been working with her. In fact, the governor is going to sign some of the legislation that I sponsored that the First Lady had also been an advocate for in a ceremony in Roanoke toward the end of this month. But we've made some strides, I think, which will help us contain costs, provide better service, and better serve these children. But we still have some work to do, so we're going to continue that study and try to come up with some working models that will enable us to more effectively meet the needs of these children. It's one of those societal type issues where it's an ever-growing problem, where it's almost impossible to get a handle on it because the problem continues to grow even as we attempt to address some of the issues related to it. One of the areas that I've had, I didn't start out this way, but it was mentioned that I'm a Republican. But I've attempted over the last few years, I guess, to fashion myself as more of a Teddy Roosevelt-type Republican, if you will, and particularly in the area of land conservation and advocacy for our state park system. And if you've not had an opportunity to get out and visit any of our state parks or natural heritage areas, I would certainly encourage you to do that because we are recognized. It's a really interesting statistic. When you look at our state park system right now, we are ranked as the number one state park system in the nation in terms of what is there and the opportunities that we afford our citizens. At the same time, and this is the ironic part, when you look at the per capita expenditures that we put into our state park system, we are 50th out of 50. In other words, we pay the least to get the best. Now, that's hard to imagine that we do that. There's a combination of factors there, certainly a dedicated workforce within the state park system, some unique assets that we manage that are there, but it's something for us all to take some pride in it. We've also this whole notion of land conservation is something that we've been working on, and indeed the greater Albemarle area is an area where the local governing bodies, in concert with the initiatives we've made at the state level, have, I think, done a good job in terms of preserving some of our land. We worked on that a bit this past session in a couple different ways. And one of the things that I'm especially pleased with is back, I guess my interest in this area peaked about 8 or 9 years ago. I chaired a commission, actually it was a subcommittee of a commission that worked first on land conservation in the state park system and then on farmland preservation. And I sponsored some legislation which created a tax credit program, and that really has become one of the – I didn't realize it at the time because when I went in front of the Finance Committee and told them what I thought it would cost the state in terms of tax credits, I told them, oh, I didn't know, maybe somewhere between $1 million and $2.5 million a year. Well, we capped it last year at $100 million a year, which actually that has turned out to be a great thing. It's one of the driving forces behind the fact that we are conserving a significant amount of land now. We're under an agreement with the Chesapeake Bay Agreement that we are within the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We are supposed to meet a goal of setting aside 20% of the land area in the Chesapeake Bay watershed by the year 2010. Right now, we're closing in on that. We're probably about 18% or so. We're about 225,000 acres short of our goal, but it at the current rate, it's very doable for us to achieve that goal. Governor Kane also kind of superimposed over that a goal of his own a couple of years ago, shortly after he had come into office, and about wanting to conserve 400,000 acres while he was in office. And that is stepping it up a little bit, but I think it's doable for us to do that. I have a, not that I want to upstage him at all, but I have a broader goal in that I would like to see us, because we've really only gotten serious about permanently conserving land as a way of maintaining water quality and lifestyle since really about the year 2000. I would like to see our goal be to achieve 1 million acres, certainly by 2012, 2013. I think it's doable for us to do that if we can reach a level of 100,000 acres per year and then maintain that for the next 5 or 6 years. I think we can reach that milestone of 1 million acres, or in total, conserved land in the Commonwealth about 4 million acres, which would be roughly 16% of the land mass. Now, you know, as a conservative Republican, maybe, well, why you want to do that? Well, there are lots of good reasons, I think, for doing that. It all relates to water quality, farmland preservation, and a lot of other intangibles, I guess, if you will, that are very important, not only for our environment, but for our overall quality of life and maintenance of the heritage, really, that we have in front of us. We are actually going to be meeting Monday and Tuesday of this week in Lake Anna State Park to discuss some of our land conservation initiatives, particularly programs for purchase and development rights to help farmers remain in business, and also monies of a dedicated funding source to assist farmers in putting in place best management practices so we don't allow nutrients from farming operations to get into the streams, into the rivers, and then into the bay so that it kills all the fish and all of those things. So at any rate, that's an ongoing issue. One of the areas that I started last year in terms of an initiative, and I'm hoping it will become, if not the biggest, one of the biggest, I'm hoping it will become one of the biggest things that I've ever been involved with, because I think it deserves that kind of effort. We have in Virginia, unfortunately, just like the rest of the nation, a tremendous problem with substance abuse. And because of that, there are implications that run deep and are widespread throughout our budget. And as taxpayers, we all pay a price from our pocketbooks, as well as the costs that we individually are confronted with from a personal standpoint, with the personal tragedies that we're confronted with. And I think as we reflect, each and every one of us, I would expect, there may be someone here who's very fortunate, but for the most part, I think all of us can reflect on situations in our own immediate and extended family where some form of substance abuse has become an issue. It's an issue to the point that quality of life suffers, and I think it's something that we need to address. Not only that, but from a standpoint of a conservative Republican, I've never fashioned myself as being anti-tax. I want low taxes. But on the other hand, when services are required, I think we should be willing to pay for them. But we can reduce what we have to pay if we can change behavior to a certain extent. So with that in mind, I sponsored legislation the year before last, which created a study by our Legislative Audit and Review Commission of substance abuse programs that are currently out there, substance abuse treatment programs, and then at the same time to study all the cost implications of substance abuse. And by that I'm talking about state corrections. Right now we are confronted with an ever-growing population in state corrections where it looks like, based on projections, we're going to have to build one additional 1,000-bed prison each year for the next 5 or 6 years. What does that cost? It costs about $100 million for each prison that we build, and then it costs an additional $25 million annually to operate that 1,000-bed facility. Currently, we're approaching about 40,000 inmates incarcerated at any one point in time in Virginia, at an annual cost of slightly over $1 billion per year. I'm suggesting there's a tremendous opportunity to save money right there when we take note of the fact that roughly 60% of the individuals that we incarcerate have some form of substance abuse that was either direct or indirect cause for their becoming incarcerated in the first place. Related also, numerous programs. You can tick off a list of about a dozen program areas where taxpayer dollars are required to support those programs because or tangentially related to substance abuse, whether it be unintended pregnancies, where right now in our inner cities approximately 80% of the live births are paid for through Medicaid to unwed single mothers, or broken families where substance abuse might be an issue there, child support enforcement, foster care issues, the juvenile domestic relations court itself, and all the myriad of problems that it's confronted with. But they're huge sums of money that I think we can identify. So now the JLARC is supposed to have a report available to us later this spring, probably in June, and I had legislation this past session which will then form a legislative commission that will take those findings and try to come up with some policy recommendations that will help us deal more effectively with substance abuse issues. I think we can do it. I would hope that it will. What will develop from it is a fairly significant new area of initiatives where we have government entities aligning themselves with some of the efforts in the faith-based community to allow us to accomplish this. But I'm hoping it will grow into a major undertaking for us. A couple other areas just in passing here. I enjoy at times, you know, local governments like to criticize state governments. As a state legislator, I've been very involved in sometimes working with and sometimes criticizing the federal government for the issue of federalism, the federal government attempting to do things that I think are really they don't have the constitutional authority to do, or where they're mandating things to us that they shouldn't be mandating to us. And to assist in that, last year I had the fortunate opportunity of chairing the Budget and Revenue Committee for the National Conference of State Legislators, which we had representatives on that committee from all 50 states, and I was able to chair it, and it gave me kind of a platform to speak out. In fact, went to Boston and had a tea party up there. We had this schooner sitting out in the bay where they had the original tea party, and we had these crates on it, and one of our issues that we had a problem with was No Child Left Behind, which is a federal mandate to the states and local governments. So we had this crate, you know, with No Child Left Behind on it. We chunked that into the bay. The Real ID Act, where the federal government now, because of Homeland Security issues, wants essentially through the Real ID to mandate to the states that we're going to have a national identification card. There's some real issues with that, not the least of which is the tremendous cost to the states that the federal government is passing on, not paying for it. So we had one Real ID, and we chunked that crate into the bay. A couple other issues like that where we had various concerns, and we had a little fun but made our points. There's some very valid issues, and our Congress right now is engaged on some of those, trying to make some reforms. I had bills, in fact, in Richmond this past session, asking our State Board of Education to make one final push with our federal Congress, since they didn't give us appropriate waivers from No Child Left Behind, for us just to withdraw. And, of course, they're threatening to withhold about $300 million in funds if we do that, but that's an ongoing conversation. On the Real ID, I had an initiative similar in concept, which was saying, well, we should do as South Carolina and a couple of the other states are currently doing and say, no, thank you. Montana, I think most recently, saying, no, thank you. We're just not going to participate, and you can't make us do it. Well, we didn't pass that bill. I carried it over, but I am engaged in a dialogue with our commissioner of the Department of Motor Vehicles, who's taken the lead in Virginia, trying to come up with some system in Virginia where we can do something a little different. It's my contention that our Department of Motor Vehicles should be in the business of determining whether or not we can drive and then giving us a driver's license as evidence of that, rather than being the focal point for an identification card, and that we should come up with some other system for verifying that we are citizens and entitled to the benefits that come with citizenship. But that's an ongoing subject. Y'all might want to talk about transportation. I'm going to talk a little bit about it, and then if y'all ask me, I'll talk about it a little bit more. I had the opportunity, of course, the governor has announced a proposal a couple days ago, which is already, by some accounts, dead even before we get started. But it is a tough time. It's a tough time to have unmet needs and then to look for resources in order to accommodate those unmet needs. There's no question about that. And as a result of that, I'd have to share that there's not, in all fairness to the governor, there's not a lot about what he advanced that I can support. So I'm trying to figure out how can we do this. Quite frankly, 3.5 months ago, when we were in Richmond, and when the pump in Stanton, where I just came by, said 269, and it looked like it was going to go down further, I supported. Actually, I introduced a bill which helped repeal the abusive driver fees. But I asked that we substitute for that 2 cents on the gas tax, increase the gas tax by 2 cents, which would raise a little over $100 million a year. The repeal of the abuser fee passed, which that reduced the money we have in transportation, roughly $60 million a year. But the other part of it didn't pass. That was stripped out. The other initiative that I passed just 3.5 months ago when the price, as high as that was $2.69 rather than the $3.69 that it is today, was an initiative that would have added 1 penny to the fuel tax each year for the next 5 years. I still think that makes sense, but it's tough. It's a very tough one politically to stand out and convince someone else that you're right. One of the reasons I think it's right, obviously, is the market is determining the price. And North Carolina, a few years back, took an initiative that Virginia kind of blinked at that time. But they based their, we have 17.5 cents per gallon, and it's been that since 1986. In fact, I called Governor Blyles. Governor Blyles hangs out here in Charlottesville nowadays. I don't know if y'all see him on the street or at McDonald's or wherever he hangs out, but he's the director of the Miller Center. Well, called him up yesterday, and he was tied up. Anyway, he called me back right before I came over here, and we had a nice conversation about what we should do with transportation and his thoughts and ideas on that. But the last time the gas tax was increased was under his tenure back in 1986. Prior to that, each governor, as he was relating to me from his historical memory, had, whether it be Dalton or Holton or Godwin, had increased it a penny or two during their term. So it was gradually coming up, you know, to keep pace with things. But then we've had like a 22-year drought where there's not been an adjustment. In North Carolina, they benchmarked that as a percentage of the cost back a few years ago. And while our gas tax has remained at 17.5 cents, theirs right now is roughly 31.5 cents. And you know what? You know what you see when you go to the pump? No difference. In fact, I asked the truckers who go down through North Carolina last week. The market is absorbing that tax. So $3.69 here in Virginia today for the low grade, you're going to find it if you go down to Charlotte, it's going to be $3.69 or maybe even lower. I talked to a fellow yesterday who was surprised. He filled up at the state line thinking that he was going to have to pay that additional heavy tax down there. When he got about 100 miles into North Carolina, discovered that, one, he was already ready to get into South Carolina, but the other was the price of gas was 4 cents cheaper than he paid in Virginia.
I've always wondered, going back to basic economics, why is it that every state in the country pays essentially the same price per gallon, maybe a nickel here and there?
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly seems to me like it's a monopoly and oligarchy and controlled prices. And how do oil companies get away with that?
You have asked a very good question, and that points to the fact I probably should move into the questions now, because I think you essentially, at least from my perspective, have hit the nail on the head. While our government has been sitting scratching its head, and I'm talking at the federal level now, wondering what if anything could be done but let the markets operate. We're all probably to varying degrees for a free market system, but we don't have a free market in the oil industry anymore. It is, at best, an oligopoly, but probably more a monopoly. And in that instance, it's very appropriate for government to step in to control that monopolistic market for the benefit of everyone. I think we're about at that point, quite frankly, or if not past it by a few years. There are a lot of other things going on out there, and obviously this gets above my pay grade, but in raising the question, I think in terms of the futures market and the market that is where as a commodity, oil and related to that, grain is now being in the speculative market where it's people are hedging that just like they would gold. I think that's driving the price more so than the actual costs that would be associated with it. That's a